And then the fight picks up and you start moving again throughout everything. And so in that 10th hour, I went around the corner of a building and it felt like I got hit in the stomach with a sledgehammer. And next thing you know, I'm laid out on the ground, pain worse than anything I'd ever felt in my life. I crawl back to my headset, I got knocked off. I put him on and I just like muster up as much strength as I could to start talking on the radio, telling my teammates I'd been shot. I remember afterwards, my team sergeant, he made me repeat myself a couple times. What am I not saying clearly? I've been shot. This is my call sign, my location. And he's like, I just didn't believe you'd been shot because you were so calm on the radio.
Welcome to Combat Story. I'm Ryan Fugit, and I serve Warzone Tours as an Army Attack helicopter pilot and CIA officer over a 15-year career. I'm fascinated by the experiences of the elite in combat. On this show, I interview some of the best to understand what combat felt like on their front lines. This is Combat Story. Today we hear the combat story of Kevin Flake, a former Green Beret and Purple Heart recipient who served multiple deployments, including two to Afghanistan. Kevin was shot in the abdomen during his second deployment and took years recovering from the associated physical and emotional scars, and has shown that it is possible to not only fully recover from such an injury, but to thrive. He's a graduate of both MIT and Harvard, sits on the board of directors at the Green Beret Foundation, is a sought-out motivational speaker, and shares his story of perseverance through a blog and outreach series called Wounded by War. Kevin was recommended to me by Bo Wise, a former guest on the show who lost two of his brothers to the war in Afghanistan, one of whom Kevin served with. I hope you enjoy this inspiring insight from the brink of death to tremendous success as much as I did. Kevin, thanks for taking the time to share your story today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me here today. It means a lot.
So we have a common person who both know, Bo Wise. And I wanted to start here. In fact, I think I had reached out to you before this, but I interviewed Bo, and the people who listen to this podcast will recall. We talked to him about his heartbreaking story as a former Marine and then losing two of his brothers to the war in Afghanistan. But after I interviewed him, he said, hey, Ryan, you need to interview this guy, Kevin, which is why I doubled down and really wanted to connect with you. But since that is a commonality for us, I would just ask, what is your connection to him, if you could share with us?
Sure. Yeah, Bo Wise is, he became like a brother to me. And unfortunately, we got brought together through some rough circumstances. Bo's brother, Ben, was the junior medic on my team for the entire time that I was on the team, there for almost 3 years. And unfortunately, Ben was killed in action just 2 weeks before a team was supposed to come home from Afghanistan. And Ben is the second boy in the family to die in Afghanistan. The oldest brother, Jeremy, was a Navy SEAL, and he was contracting for the CIA, and he was killed in the Fob Chapman attacks. I'll never forget, actually. We're getting ready to go on our first Afghanistan rotation. I was in the first Special Forces group at the time. My unit had typically been doing, Philippines rotations, Iraq rotations, and then, going to Thailand, Bangladesh, some of the other areas in Asia to kind of cover for the joint combined exercise training. And so we're getting ready to go on our first Afghanistan rotation. I'm 25 years old and I am a nervous wreck, just like, wow, like, am I ready to do this? Am I going to fail my teammates? Not even really worried about dying, more worried about failing people. And it was 3 days before we were supposed to go, I got a call and said, hey, Ben's not going to be able to make the deployment. We don't really know, if he's going to be able to come at all. His brother was just killed. And so got that call about 3 days before I was supposed to go on my first deployment. And you talk about a gut check, or you talk about a reality check about what you're going into. And that hit home really, really close at that point there. So that was right before my first deployment that Jeremy died. Ben, straight up warrior. Like, at the end of the day, it was the team. Everything was about the team. Ben had just had his first son too. And so he's getting, he has your first son. I can't imagine what it'd be like. I didn't have kids at the time to go on that first deployment, or to go on a deployment and leave your family and your kids behind. So not only does that happen, but then his brother is killed. And Ben got to us as soon as he possibly could. Like, he missed maybe the first month of the deployment, had to spend some time with the family. He's the oldest boy in the family now, right? Everything's falling on his shoulders and taking care of things back stateside, going to memorials, going to funerals. And, you know, then he's like, all right, it's time for me to go. And goes on the deployment when a lot of people are like, look, man, maybe you should sit this one out, right? And he goes on the deployment. He's there within a month. I'll never forget the first day that he was there, and he like grabs me. I'm the newest guy on the team. I'm the cherry, right? You know, everybody's just crapping all over me all the time. I didn't know anything. I don't blame him. And he's like, all right, grab your shit. Let's go. And he's like, we're in between Connexes practicing CQB. And, you know, he's just getting after it with me. And that kind of really came to define our relationship of someone who was just looking out for me, not just as a soldier, but as a friend, follower of Christ. He taught me how to read the Bible. Incredible man. I could go on and on about him and the Wise family and how I became so close to Bo kind of through all of this and through this trauma, the shared connection. With Ben's wife and Tracy, and the Wise family is just a incredible family that I hold very dear in my heart, and they're the epitome of resilience.
Yeah. It's a great book too, The Three Wise Men. And I know I've seen on some of your feeds, you feature it occasionally, and it's heartbreaking. And I hate having to start out with this, but it's powerful, I know. And he was brother to you in combat. So I thought we'd kick off there. And you mentioned something that I would like to just touch on for a minute. Usually I start off with growing up, like what you were like as a kid, but just because you brought this up, you were a nervous wreck going into that first deployment. You're worried about failing. As we kind of tie this back to you and your childhood, was that new to you? I mean, you'd played sports in college, which we'll get to, but like, did you always feel like you didn't want to let people down? Was it just the fear of the unknown? Where did that come from?
I always played sports growing up. I was a big team sports guy. So it was always, I always put the team above yourself, right? And football was my thing, played lacrosse too, but like didn't want to let the guy to the left and right me down, right? That was always what, would keep me up. And then at the same time too, like at 14, I knew I wanted to be a Green Beret, right? So now I'm in the situation in which I am fulfilling my life's goal. And, you know, for me at like 25, being Green Beret and going to Afghanistan, like this is like the Olympics. This is the Super Bowl. This is it. Like, this is my moment to really shine and see what I'm made of here. But with the consequences so grave of, what outcomes could be. But for me, that was what kind of drove this. It wasn't necessarily fear of failure. It was more so like, I just didn't want to let my teammates down. And honestly, I think if you talk to anybody on my team or most other teams, right, you have 12 guys on a special forces team. You put that body armor on, you go out. To me, that always meant there's 11 other people's lives that are more important than mine. But like, I'd rather die than see anything happen to them. And I think there's just that love and that mentality. So for me, it was just a very nerve-wracking experience kind of going into it, because I had a very different experience than most people in special forces, right? Or just the military, I'd say, probably in general. I got to my company. And if you think of a special forces company, there's six teams in a company, six A teams. And then there's a B team, which is the support team for it. That's kind of where the command element sits also. And I get there and they said, all right, hey, the teams are full up on Charlie's. I was an engineer, right? 18 Charlie, that's your special forces designator. And they're like, all right, you're gonna go to the B team. You know, I'm immediately crushed, right? I'm like, oh my God, I went through this whole training. I couldn't wait to get to a team. And I'm going to the support team. And like, a lot of times if you screw up or something happens, they send you to the support team. And so a lot of my buddies are looking at me like, dude, they would be like, where'd you fuck up, man? What happened, bro? Like,
you just got here.
That's a stud. Right. And so now I'm on the support team and I'm like, all right, well, the surest way to get to a team is to just work your ass off. Right. I'm going to be seen and not heard, and I'm going to be here. I'm going to open the company up. I'm going to close the company down. I'm going to be working all the time. And that was my mentality. Got to go to the Philippines and kind of on the support team. Instead of being at the range shooting, I'm like fixing toilets and, making sure generators are going and running water, and handling logistics in a developing country, which is not that, people come back and like, yeah, why don't we have power right now? I'm like, Because we're in the Philippines, bro. That's why. Okay. And so I was like, all right, just keep working, keep working. And we get the orders to go to Afghanistan. And they said, we get back to the States. We got the orders in the Philippines. We get back to the States. We're going to go to Afghanistan in 4 months. It's a pretty short time frame, right? To do your train up, to do everything. And keep in mind too, like first group, we've just been doing majority Iraq and Philippines rotations. And so now it's a whole new ball game to go to Afghanistan, completely different place. So we have a very short window to get everything prepped. And I'm thinking I'm going to a team as soon as I get back from the Philippines. And then they're like, hey, you know, Kevin, you've done such a great job as the B team, Charlie. You know, we're gonna keep you there for Afghanistan. You know, you're an E5, man. You're doing better than most E7s would do. And I was just like, absolutely. Like, my heart was ripped out of my chest. Christmas was canceled as a 4-year-old. And I was like, wow. You know, because people were like, look, man, you better be careful. But you're going to work yourself into a job here. And I didn't believe them, but like I had. And so that was like just, you know, absolutely awful for me to have that happen. But then, you know, I'm still like, all right, well, this is the situation you're in. You wanted to be a Green Beret. Like, you got to do the best that you can with it. And, you know, for a couple months, really kind of put my head down, was doing whatever I could, get the company ready to go on the deployment. And then all of a sudden one day, they're like, hey, Kevin, you know, grab your shit and get down to 1316. I said, what are you talking about? One of the guys on the team tore his pec, so he couldn't go on the deployment. So I get to the team, and like, we're just getting ready to palletize to go to Afghanistan. Right. So this is the first time I'm like really meeting a lot of these guys. The first person meeting was Ben Wise. I open the door and he's like, can I help you? Like, oh my God, I'm, you know, the new guy. This is awful, terrible. And I get there and, you know, we palletize our stuff and, you know, we go on 2 weeks to leave and go to Afghanistan. The first time I open my gun box is in Afghanistan. That's the first time that I shot it. Right. The first time I did a mission with my team was in Afghanistan. I didn't know how to even talk on the radios with them. I'd never done it before. I didn't know any of their SOPs. I had like the first live fire drill I ever did with them was a 5-hour firefight. You know, the first time I drove a Humvee, Afghanistan, right? I'll never forget being in the op center and they're like, hey, Kevin, you're going to be on the 50 cal tomorrow. And I'm like, oh my, no, like, oh, really? Oh, okay. Oh, like, excuse me, but I don't even know how to load a 50 cal. And then you're like, what the fuck, Kevin? Who the fuck are you? And I'm like, oh my God. I was like, what do you do? Do you say you don't know how to do it or not? And they're, you know, I'm like, look, guys, like, dude, at basic training, they load it for you and you fire 10 rounds, man. And then we did no 50 cal training in the Q course, and I didn't get to do any train up at all. So I don't know how to even load a 50 cal. And they're like, okay, well, we're going to go teach you tonight. And then, you know, like literally using it the next day. So it was a different experience. Everything for me that I did in Afghanistan was pretty much for the first time. But
wow.
Luckily I had an amazing team with amazing NCOs. They don't get me wrong. They were like absolutely brutal to me, but brutal with a point, maybe sometimes, right? But you were really there to teach me and to mentor me.
Wow. That's so interesting. When you say that at the age of 14, you wanted to be a Green Beret and then you were kind of living it, you know, I can certainly appreciate that. Here I am, like, I'm going on my first deployment. It's to Afghanistan. Like, I got to break myself in. Where did the desire at 14 come from? What was the seed that was planted for you to be a Green Beret?
Yeah. Well, actually, hopefully too, though, you understand a little bit more why I was,
Oh yeah. No, I got you.
C-130, like, oh boy. And like my senior wasn't even going to be there for the first month and a half of deployment. I was Charlie One, right? Like, the desire, right? Where did that come from? It comes from the upbringing. It comes from my earliest memories, right? I'm from a small town in upstate New York called Stillwater, New York. I'm sure, you know the Battle of Saratoga, right? From the Revolutionary War, the turning point. that battle was actually fought in Stillwater, right? So it really should be the Battle of Stillwater. And, like, my house where I grew up is right next to the battlefield. My house was an old, like, British encampment right on the Hudson River. Find musket balls once in a while, all that good stuff. So I'm kind of just brought up in this environment. You know, I'm in the heart of where the revolution was. It's always there, the history of things. I had a grandfather in World War II, another family members in like Korea. And so that was always kind of prevalent within my face. And my father, he never served in the military, but had this huge appreciation for it, right? Like, as kids, we could watch any World War II videos, 4 or 5 years, didn't care, right? Because it's history, right? And that's what happened. And he was an entrepreneur, right? He grew up dirt poor. He didn't have anything growing up, finished second to last in his high school class, didn't graduate from college, but just knew he wanted to make money and just started all these businesses, series of different businesses. You know, he would be at parades, pushing a cart around, selling balloons, right? He's like, I didn't care what people thought of me, I was making money. And he finally has this concept of coming up with dollar stores. And he does it kind of in the late 80s and the 90s. He saw it down south work. He opened up in the Northeast, in New York, Vermont, Massachusetts, and at its peak had about 30 stores. And so I grew up with this entrepreneurship kind of mindset of like, if you have this idea, if there's something you believe in, you can get out there and you can achieve it. Right? I just saw him put the work into it. And my mother, every day before we go to school, she said, you're a flight, you're an achiever. And so she planted that seed. She believed in us. It wasn't like, hey, you deserve things. It was like, you get your ass out there and you achieve, right? You do things. That's the expectation here in this family. And so as kids, you know, 10, 11 years old, you know, we got to go to school. My dad liked sports. So we got to play sports and we got to work. You know, I remember in the summertime, we'd have our breaks in his warehouse. The Little League field was near us. And I'd hear like the kids playing out there and he's yelling at us because we were 1 minute over on break, right? But as much as I hated that and I hated spending my summers doing that, it taught me the value of hard work and what you can do. And so I realized at a pretty young age that there wasn't too many things out there that if I knew I wanted to do it, I could achieve it. And kind of fast forward, you know, in the environment I was brought up into in Stillwater, this town was amazing. Great coaches, great teachers, great family members that were very supportive of me. I had the great fortune to go to an all-boys Catholic military school. I didn't think that it was the great fortune at the time when you're like 12 to 18, you know. But I went there and that, I think, was really fostered, right? That work ethic, that believing in things, believing in yourself. And I learned to love God, love country, and put others above yourself. And so one day in military science class, 14 years old, we're watching the Navy SEAL Hell Week video, the famous one, right? And half the class is staring out the window and the other half is like not paying attention because they're 14. And I'm like, oh my God, that's it right there. Like, that's what I want to do with my life. And I'm like, this is it, right? This is the way to love your country, right? To love God, to put others above yourself. Like the barrier to entry, the difficulty, the brotherhood. It was from that point on, I'm like, there's nothing else that's going to match this.
Why Army SF and not SEALs then?
Well, I mean, I'm bald. I don't have enough hair for that. You know,
you wouldn't look good on the beach. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not going to win any beauty contests. So that's part of the problem, right? I always say I got to give it to the SEALs, right? They're the ones that got me interested in this. But as I got older, and I went, you know, I ended up going to college first, and it started time to get serious. So 9/11 happened my senior year of high school, right? So it's this kind of fantasy. It's this fascination. And now it's a duty to do this. And, you know, go to college fully with the intention of preparing myself to join the military right afterwards. From day one, I'm like, that's all I'm doing. I never went to a career fair or anything like that. It's like, let's go to the recruiter's office. And I kind of surveyed everything in special operations and, you know, looked at, you know, what each branch had and what each one did and their kind of specialty. And for me personally, I was like, De Oppresso Liber, right? To free the oppressed, the Green Berets, 12-man team, go to foreign countries. You're learning languages, cultures, customs, like Peace Corps with guns here. You're fighting, you're digging wells. Like, this is amazing. Like, so at 22, you know, my 18 to 22 phase, I'm like, that is like, why would I want to do anything else in my life? And like people are always like, oh man, are SEALs better than Green Berets or Rangers? And like there's just no comparison. You know, everybody has their unique niche that they fill in the special operations umbrella, and they do it incredibly well. And I think what it just is like the only comparison you can have is like the type of person that attracts some pretty damn incredible human beings.
Yeah.
That, you know, are remarkable in every sense of the fashion. So,
I will say also, given the timing of 9/11 for you, right when 9/11 kicked off, Green Berets were heavily featured in those initial fights, like yeah. storied experiences, riding in on horseback, like behind enemy lines, right on the front of everything. There were the people everyone was talking about in the press. Yeah. It was a big deal then.
For sure. And that was very influential, right? I'm like, yeah. you know, reading Masters of Chaos and like, you know, reading about the horse soldiers. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. That was big.
I'm going to ride around on a horse. I never rode a horse, but yeah.
So why the decision to go to college then and not go directly in? And why not go the commission route, just out of curiosity?
Sure. So the reasoning, you know, behind everything. So initially I was like, well, I'm going to do it at West Point, right? A lot of the guys from my high school were at West Point or Annapolis, you know, Air Force or, you know, some of the ROTC. By my junior year of our high school, I'm like, no way. You know, I'd get inspected every morning. I've had military grooming standards since I was 14. You would be marching instead of going to gym class. Like, no. I don't know how. So some guys do it. I don't know. Like from the age of like 12 to 22, they go to military school. And it's like, I can just do like OCS or ROTC. And, you know, went to college, you know, full, like I said, I'm going to join the military afterwards. I tried ROTC for like a week. I just honestly was not like straightened on enough at the time to do it. I was playing football for president of my fraternity. I really enjoyed partying, had a really tough time going to all my classes, during the week. And so I'm like, yeah, let's go to ROTC. Right. But the more I thought about it, like, you know, reading those books about the special forces guys and hearing more about the horseback and digging into it, I want to be a Green Beret. And there really wasn't an avenue, you know, as an officer, you'd have to be a captain.
Yeah. Right?
And you go to OCS, you don't get to pick what you want. You could be the best in the class. I want to be an infantry platoon leader. It's well, yeah, but we need good guys in supply. Right. So I didn't really want to roll the dice and put my hands in fate there. I knew I wanted to be a Green Beret and there was an avenue to do it. And that was through the 18 X-ray program. And so for me, it was like, you know, let's do this. And then if I want to go to OCS at some point, I can go to OCS or stay in. There's so many avenues I could go with. And yeah. what I found was a lot of the 18 X-rays that I went through who were successful, they were older typically, right? They weren't just 18 years old. They had some college experience, maybe some work experience. I went to basic training with a guy who had 2 master's degrees and was working for NASA. He's a literal rocket scientist.
Wow.
And then he becomes a Green Beret.
Jeez, that's impressive. I was at the agency with a guy like that too. And I was like, why are you walking away from that career? But it's the same thing that draws all of us, I believe. Yeah. I can appreciate what you said about playing football in college. I know you and I were chatting about it beforehand. I also played when I was there. I also did ROTC. And I distinctly remember like getting up to go PT while my roommates who were also on the football team were like staggering home from a bar. You know, I'm like, these are poor life decisions I'm making right now. Like, why am I up this early? Why are they coming home this late? But it is a lot to have on your shoulders at that time. Oh, man. So if we transition then to your time going into the military, I have not heard the 18 X-ray program the way you've just described it. So is it like we had high school to flight school in the aviation community? Is it truly like you're just pipelining straight into SF?
Yeah. So you would sign a contract before you go to basic training, the 18 X-ray contract. And essentially what it would do is guarantee you an opportunity to go to special forces selection. And so you would go to basic training, you go to infantry training, airborne school, you complete everything successfully. You don't screw up and have your contract taken away from you. You know, then you'd have that opportunity to go to that month-long selection process. And if you're selected, then you would get to go through the Q course from there.
And in that community, it seems like from the outside, many of the folks in the SF community also have a Ranger tab. Is that part of that transition for, or the training pipeline for you guys? Or is it that you omit that and you might pick it up later?
Yeah, you might go to Ranger school at some point later. You know, I think I was supposed to go to Ranger school after my first deployment, but then we had orders to go back to Afghanistan. So that kind of, you know, I wasn't that sad to
right. see that. I'm curious if people, maybe in the post 9/11 era, it's different versus the pre. Is there any stigma for not having that tab in that community, or when you're having a Ranger tab in that community?
I mean, there was quite a bit of people that didn't have it through chance and circumstance. I mean, the deployment schedules are so crazy,
right?
You know, to then say, "Hey, I know you just went to Afghanistan for 7 months, and in 7 more months you're going to go back, but we're going to need you to go beat the crap out of yourself again for 63 to 90 days here, depending on if you're recycling anything."
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I think there would have been a ton of value in me going there in terms of the leadership, what you could have learned there. But it just was, you know, I think they're just, you know, for me, there wasn't the time and there wasn't necessarily, you know, the stigma of it.
Right.
But my team sergeant didn't have his Ranger tab.
Yeah.
My warrant officer didn't have his Ranger tab.
Very interesting. And clearly for you, Kevin, I mean, you are very accomplished. Like in what you've done even since serving in the military. I mean, graduated from MIT, Harvard, investment bank, and you've done all sorts of things. Very happy family life, as it appears. I'm very curious about if that was something that you just kind of grew up with these ambitions. Like it sounds like you had a strong value set placed on you through your parents, the work ethic through military school. What you've done since the military, do you feel like that drive and ambition was always there with you, even going in through like the Q course and that pipeline, trying to succeed?
I definitely think that it's been there. It's just kind of been fostered throughout my whole life, with parents and coaches and teachers and mentors. I think after getting wounded, I had to have that drive. I needed to have these huge goals for me to go out and achieve, to motivate myself, you know, to not fall into depression. And for me too, I think it was like I got to prove to people that I'm good, like that everything's going really good for me. And I think there's also an element too of like, when I got out of the military, I had a chip on my shoulder. But I wanted to be a guy that I could show people that could transition out of the military and go and do these great things, right? I had this fear of, you know, I'll never forget, I was like 26 or 27. I'm sitting on the back of a Chinook. It's 2 or 3 in the morning. We're getting ready to go do a raid. And I look back, there's like 40 Afghans that I'm in charge of. You know, my backpack's full of C4, my M4's in between my legs. And I'm like, is this the coolest you'll ever be? and so I didn't want to peak at that age. Now, what I've came to realize, right, at 37 now, and being out of graduate school for about 5 years, is like, it's not that like I was peaking at that age. It was just kind of like that was the peak for that age, right? And now I'm on to different phases of my life. And so one of the things I've really worked on doing is not comparing everything to that, right? Nothing will compare to it. It's not a bad thing because it's just different phases of life that I'm in right now. And so like, wow, what I'm saying is like, hey, let's peak in each phase of your life, right? And let's like not compare it to these other phases.
That's really interesting. And I'm glad that you brought up the injury. We will get to it. And I just didn't want to include it when I asked the question, but I was wondering if there was something about that injury that just sparked some type of ambition, not ambition, like you clearly have it, but just like some other type of, hey, I'm going to go out and do even more now as a result of this. And it sounds like there was something there.
Yeah,
that was a part of it.
Awesome.
So if we can, then let's backtrack. So you come out of the college, you go into the 18 X-ray program. That kind of explains how you arrive at your unit after the, I guess, selection Q course. You arrive at your unit. You don't have this time that maybe other guys have spent in other infantry units or some other conventional side. Is that right? Like you're just showing up straight from training to the SF world?
Yeah, I mean, right, like 2 years prior, I'm the captain of my football team.
Wow.
Right? Here's my training. And don't get me wrong. Those are great leadership challenges and experiences. It was literally like the best I could be doing at that time for myself.
Man, how, just as we talk about that training, selection, Q course, how did it compare to maybe like the rigor of football training over 4 years, the brotherhood that you felt there? How would you compare those two?
I mean, I think definitely being an athlete, being a collegiate athlete and playing at that level very much helped me prepare. So physical fitness had always been something that was really big to me. So it wasn't necessarily a problem to kick it up even more, right? Pushing yourself, you know, digging down deep. It's the fourth quarter. Your body hurts. You're exhausted and you still got more to give, right? And then having that, like the guy to your left and right that you don't want to, you don't want to let them down. And so I firmly believe that playing sports, that helped me out so much in terms of developing that mental mindset of not quitting, not giving up and saying, you know what? I will never be the best player on this field. I just knew it. I'll never be the fastest. I'll never be the most athletic. Like, but there's two things that nobody else will do better than me. No one will outwork me. That is for sure. Right. No, though, like I will leave it out here and I will give more than anybody. And I'd say no one's going to be a better leader than me. Right. When I was in college, that was my role. I went there saying, I'm going to be the best player that's ever played here. That was kind of the ambition that I had and the hubris, right?
Yeah.
Being 18. You know, after, you know, a year or two, you realize that, look, man, it's not in your cards, but what you can be is like one of the, like the best leader. Right. That's going to be how you're really going to contribute to this team, to this program, to the legacy. So I think from developing that mindset of never quitting and working hard and achieving these goals, right? Because, you know, in January, you're lifting weights for a game in October, right? The Q course, it's a 2-year time frame. And then learn so much about leadership being in those environments. And was a 2-time captain of the football team. I learned to make some hard decisions, 21, 22 years old.
Yeah, that's interesting. You almost developed some of these leadership skills before the military. Well, I mean, you had military school. So certainly I would imagine that influenced how you looked at leadership. But before the formal army got its hands on you, you were already leading, right? Like, how would you have looked at your leadership style going in? Because I know, as you said, you're sitting in a Chinook, you got 40 Afghans behind you, you're leading people on the battlefield later. What do you think some of your strengths were as a leader coming out of college?
I think, you know, some of my strengths, motivating people, right? That's always been my biggest strength. And I think that's probably why I gravitated towards being a Green Beret. And that's part of the biggest thing that I loved working with the foreign soldiers. Loved it. I loved motivating them, figuring out how to motivate them, how to relate to them, how to build rapport with them, and just getting them to their version of 100%. You know, when I first did my first Afghanistan rotation, I would get frustrated, you know, with these guys. Oh my God, like, you know, they're never going to be like me, or they're never going to be like anybody else. And it was a really good lesson for me to learn, because I'll never forget my high school football coach said to me, Kevin, you're going to have a really hard life. I said, well, that's, you know, I'm 17, 18 years old. Why? That's kind of a tough thing to say to somebody. Why? He said, because other people aren't like you and you won't accept that. And, you know, I would struggle with that. And I would go to, you know, I'm comparing these Afghans to these Green Berets. And I finally realized it was like my role here with them is like, to not compare them to Green Berets, to not get them to be Green Berets, but to figure out what their specific 100% is as a human being and get them to that level, right? And to be that motivator. There's a huge lesson for me in just life in general, like in the business world, in teams, right? Everybody's 100% is different. Don't hold everybody to that same standard. Get to know the people well enough so you know what their 100% is, and then you get them to break that ceiling.
Kevin, that's like sage advice right there. How do you do that in principle? Not necessarily an example, but, or when did you learn how to do that? Because I think many people who come out of the military have trouble acclimating to regular life because you're comparing what we would refer to as civilians to people who have done this elite type of work for so long. How did you learn to work around that or with that?
Well, you know, a lot of mistakes. of course, right? You know, I think of my first deployment to the Philippines as an awesome warm-up for combat, right? My first, time really in an environment like that, you know, everything is moving slower than you want it to. You have the team breathe, hey, why don't we have power? Why aren't the toilets working? I'm like, I'm trying to figure this out, you know? And it was a tough deployment for me, just in the sense of like, I'm trying to manage expectations, and I'm also trying to work with the local government folks, like the Filipino military, and their sense of urgency was not my sense of urgency, right? Like, they didn't have to go back to the barracks and just get crapped on by very seasoned Green Berets like I was going to be, doing. And so there's a lot of times I got incredibly frustrated at the situation with the people. Luckily there was no catastrophic loss of rapport, which we kind of talk about as Green Berets for the partner force. But there are some moments where, you know, I look back now, and I can't believe I acted that way. Right? There was a possibility for some type of catastrophic loss of rapport. Luckily for me, I had that experience and reflected on it when I got back, and I was like, all right, well, these are some things I need to change a little bit. And I go to Afghanistan. It's a completely different environment. And I get there and I'm like, well, I'm a Green Beret and they're going to listen to me. All right. That turns out that's not the case at all, because they've worked with Green Berets. And a lot of those guys, like, they were older than me. They had more combat experience. Oh, well, I had no combat experience. So any combat that they had initially was more than me. Right. And I just didn't do on that first deployment. I felt like I didn't do a great job of building rapport with them. And it was a lot of friction, I felt like, between myself and the Afghan commandos. And so when I got home, I thought about that a lot and thought about, like, all right, like, you know, what do I need to do to change this thing? How do I change the situation here? And so when I said, I'm going to go back on that deployment, I'm going to spend a lot of time with these guys. I'm going to, like, make these better attempts to build rapport with them. And so that second deployment, any free time that I had that I wasn't, like, working out or cleaning guns and things like that, I would try to spend with them. Drinking tea with them all the time, talking with them. Right. So they love professional wrestling. They love John Cena. And I was like, had long blonde hair, beard. I was actually like muscular instead of this like 180 pound runner that I am now. And I had my wife send me over a Hulk Hogan costume because I loved Hulk. And my mom, for some reason, kept all of my wrestling stuff from when I was a kid, like all my figurines and the ring and like my belt. She sent it over. And so I would dress up as Hulk Hogan. I would take my belt, I'd kick their door in, and then just start, like, you know, fighting with them. And they thought it was real. So I'd be like, steel chairs would be hitting me. They loved John Cena. They all thought they were John Cena. And it was an incredible way to build rapport with them, right? To show them that I saw them not as just professionals, but as friends. And I would reverse the tables too. Like, I was teaching all the time as a Green Beret. That's what we do. We're teachers. I'm like, okay, you guys need to teach me. Teach me Dari. Right. So we just sit there and they would say things and I'd phonetically write it down. And over a while, I'm like, wow, I can actually have a decent conversation with these guys. And he's, oh, this is pretty helpful in those battlefield commands here. And, you know, I'd be like, teach me about Islam. Teach me about your culture. They would teach me how to dance. And so it wasn't just me teaching them all the time. It was them teaching me and me showing them how invested I was in them and their culture and being there for them. And it paid huge, huge dividends. And, you know, that was a breakthrough, you know, doing that, you know, for me on target was so much better training, just getting them to do things and getting to that 100%. That's how I learned it. Like, and I realized that was a lesson that could apply to everything else in my life.
Wow. Yeah. Almost through trial and error, as you describe it, but I think it sounds so common sense to just spend that quality time with the people you're leading, but so many people don't do it right, for whatever reason, you know? So I guess as we talk about you in Afghanistan, you mentioned the first time you were firing with the guys on your team was in a 5-hour firefight. If you could talk us through kind of what your first combat engagement looked like, how long had you been in country? It sounds like you're probably 25 years old, maybe at the time.
Yeah. So we got in the country probably like January 3rd or something of 2010. And it was pretty interesting. Like, we were up in Kunduz in the north, and that time frame, everything is down south. Everything's focusing on Kandahar, Helmand. And so like when people got, we got orders for the north, people were like, oh, well, at least you'll be safe up there. And yeah, we get there and we're like, I don't know. And just because you say some place is safe doesn't make it safe. And the, you know, the same token, it's like, if you're a bad guy, where are you going to go? You're going to go where people aren't, right? So there wasn't a whole lot of focus on the Northern Theater at that point. I mean, we had the Afghan Commando mission and, you know, they were modeled after Ranger Battalion, and we didn't have air assets on our first deployment. And we had to cover RC North, which is like the finger of Badakhshan that touches China all the way to Faryab province, which touches Turkmenistan. That's 600 miles long or wide. And like that, and you don't have air assets to run commando style missions, right? We were supposed to fall in on a fully furnished base, right? It's like, you know, a track of gravel, some plywood, and, you know, obviously no electricity or anything to speak of. So we're like bunking up with like on the DEA side of the base that we're sharing with them. And, you know, we have like a 15 by 20 Connex with like 12 dudes in there and all the equipment. And you know, like the supply line stopped before it got to us. Like we just couldn't get what we needed to finish our bases or anything. And I don't know. I say all that just to kind of like paint the picture of what that first deployment was like up there.
And sorry, Kevin, when you said you didn't have air assets, do you mean you just didn't have like 1/60th, or you didn't even have conventional? You could get a Chinook to go do a.
Well, we didn't have conventional.
What? Yeah. You had to drive everywhere?
Yeah.
All right.
Kind of tough to cover 600 miles, right? When you're driving GMVs around. And it was GMVs too. Like we didn't get MRAPs until like the end of the deployment. We did two helicopter assaults on that deployment. The first helicopter assault that I ever did was with and I had never practiced one either.
Was somebody just like, hey, you just follow me, all right? Just hanging out on my hip.
I'm like, what the hell's going on? It's happening so fast. Like run off the helicopter and like it's nighttime, you know.
Let me ask you about that just real quick, Kevin, without obviously getting into anything too sensitive, but to somebody looking at that from the outside, they might say, why is that so hard? Like you're on a bird, you're running off of it, you're hitting a target. Don't you guys train to do that kind of thing through selection, the Q course? And like, can you add some context there, some flavor for what makes that so difficult, especially when you're talking at the JSOC level?
Yeah. I think you said it right. Like people practice it. I hadn't practiced it, right? Like I never did a helicopter assault in the Q course. Never did a helicopter assault at basic training. That's the first time that I go out and do it in that environment there, you know, with the commandos and with my team. Like I said, luckily I have incredible NCOs and you know, helping me through everything. But it's. You know, for me, I guess the best way to liken combat and operations is like, you know, when you go from like high school to college in football, the speed at which the game is played is just crazy. You're like, oh my God, everything is spinning, right? And then you're in it for a little bit longer and it slows down. It slows down to the point that you're kind of like in the Zen state and you can see these things happening before they even happen. You can predict things. To me, that's how combat was. And going on missions and like looking at maps and like, I have no clue where I am. Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. You just have to be in it and you have to do it multiple times. I think to gain that muscle memory in those situations there.
Yeah. Well said. And as you were talking about your base, right? So you guys get there, how long is it before you're running that first op, the first mission?
You know, I think I ran with a team, like with a RIP, you know, with the seventh group team that we were ripping with. And they, I'll never forget that first, you know, mission I go out there with them. It was a very low key kind of, you know, just a little patrol, show you the area type of thing. We're sitting in the back of the, that team did have an MRAP. And I just remember sitting in the back of it. It was like so hot. I thought I was going to throw up. I ended up having to start taking like meclizine for motion sickness on like helicopters and like sitting in the back of these MRAS. I didn't know it at the time though. So I can't be like, hey guys, my first mission, Cherry's going to throw up over here, you know, like sweating in there. I can't wait to get out of that thing. It just was like so awkward for me, like doing radio checks. I'm like, how do I do a radio check? I've never done a radio check. How do I call you on the radio? Like, I'm like, 1-6, Echo. Yeah, that's right. 1-6 Echo. Like, remember kind of like the nervousness and awkwardness of that first mission that I was on.
And was there even contact during that first one? Or was it just like many people that first time you're outside the wires, just like you're trying to emotionally set yourself up for, this is what it's going to be like. I got it. 6 months to a year of this, like, how do I get into this groove?
It wasn't, you know, like in your mind, like you're just gonna leave the wire.
That's
like,
right, man.
Oh my god, call in air support.
That's so true.
Crazy.
So
wasn't necessarily like that, but you know, but it was nerve wracking, right? As you're doing everything. And so you kind of fast forward to our first firefight. We had been there for a month and a half. You know, January, February are kind of slower times there. I'm anxious to get into a fight, right? I want to go to Afghanistan. I need to prove myself. I'm like, this is the way to manhood type of situation. You know, I'd had people being like, hey man, you better be careful what you wish for. And at a time, you know, you don't care. You're a kid. You want to fight. You want to go and do it. And it was a month and a half into it. I had a feeling that this town we were going to go into, it was called Nari Sufi, a fight was going to happen there, right? And so I'll never forget it. I was in the 50 cal. I think I was like the third truck that we had. And we go off of the hardball road. You know, there's typically these hardball roads in Afghanistan that are main roads. And then you turn off of them, go into these dirt roads, into these smaller villages. And so you turn off into the dirt road, and like I'm like the third truck, right? So I'm just eating dust the whole time, dust kicking up in my face, just smelling that and diesel fumes. It was kind of a pretty good, you know, thing for me for most of the deployment. And we're on this kind of main, we go off the main hardball road onto this main dirt road. And then we turn off into this even smaller dirt road to go into this village called Nari Sufi. And I'll never forget, we turn down that road. We have guys dismounted. So we'd have guys dismount on the left and the right for us. We kind of walk through. You can see if there's IEDs, right? We had a slower clearing process, but it also, you know, allowed us to not hit any IEDs while we were there. And they're dismounted, start moving forward. And, you know, my truck turns, and next thing you know, you hear that kack, 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 the PKM, AK-47s going, dropping some mortars. And I'll never forget in that instance, I just froze, felt like an eternity. And I was like, oh, so this is what it's like. And it was so cool because all of that training that everybody had given me from the time I joined the Army up until then just like seemed to kick in. And it was like snap back to reality. The captain is, I'm gunning for the captain, and he starts screaming, Kevin, you gotta fucking let me know what's going on up there, buddy. Let's go. It was like, all right, yeah, just like everything just started rolling off the tongue. You know, I'm like, hey, we got splash, like, you know, giving the distance, direction, everything that's happening, screaming at my driver, I need you to put me here. It was so cool to just then be in that environment. And that kind of went through on and on, you know, throughout the rest of the day. We keep, you know, pushing clear, push forward, clear, push forward, taking contact. More RPGs, some mortars coming here and there. And, you know, they were getting close. I'm like, holy shit, I think we're getting bracketed right now. And, you know, the closer they get, like, I would just like, hold my breath. It would land. And then start, like, feeling my arms. Like, just, oh, okay, yeah. Feel your face. It's still there. You're still good. Right? So then we finally pull the convoy up to a certain point. And you know, it's my first firefight that I'm ever in. I never had a chance to fire the 50 cal the whole time, you know, because there just wasn't like a line of sight for me to do that. And you know, our 18 Fox was in the other 50, the truck with a 50 cal. We had rural 250 cals and a Mark 19. And you know, the Fox, he's just hammering away at his 50 cal, like hammering away. They're taking ammo from my truck. I'm sitting there. Our Mark 19's going crazy. You just see bullets snapping over our Mark 19 gunner's head. And, you know, I'll never forget those two, right? There's a compound that was there. And, you know, I was screaming at the captain. I'm like, we need to fucking drop on that compound. We need to drop on that compound. And he wasn't having any of it, right? You know, he tells me to shut the fuck up. I'm the captain, right? I'm like, okay, that's right. And when the fight ends, a bunch of women and children walk out of that compound.
Wow.
And that compound was being used, right, by the Taliban to hide in there, to shoot at us, to lure us in, to drop on that compound. The captain had the foresight, probably 29, 30 years old,
right,
to not drop on that compound. You know, you'd always used to say, hey, man, that's why you make the O3 pay. I'll tell you, man, that guy, the captain, earned his O3 pay that day.
Yeah.
And I realized I didn't know everything.
And how long did this fight go on?
It was like, you know, I'd say 4 or 5 hours.
That's a long time.
Yeah. And like, you know, intermittent, right? Like people.
Yeah.
People like think it's all Black Hawk down. I'm like, man, the thing would be done in 10 minutes. Like, there's lulls, and you know, I'm looking in the ditch at one point, and the commandos are making tea, right? Because nothing's happening. You know?
That's surreal. You know, like the things that go on in combat.
Right. It's like, it's nothing that, you know, so when people hear that, like, yeah, I'm like, you're stressed as fuck. It's crazy. Everything's running through your mind. Like, I like all of a sudden I'm like, oh my God, like until 3 or 4 hours in, I'm like, I'm gonna pee my pants. I'm going, like, I've had the same dip in for 4 hours now. Right.
Nasty. And,
you know, it was just like the adrenaline, like, oh my God, this is so cool. I felt a little emasculated not being able to shoot the 50 cal, obviously. And then we were relieved by the Germans in the area. They came and secured the area for us. And when we started to leave, I was like, oh, I don't want this to end. I want it to pick back up again.
Wow.
Like it was like you kind of like your first taste was free with drugs. And, you know, I'm like, man, I'm hooked now.
Damn.
And another team in our company, all of a sudden they called in troops in contact. And you just, you know, on the rate, the same thing, you hear the 50s going, the four, you know, the 240s going. And I'm like, oh my God, I wish I was them right now. And that was my first experience in combat. And I went to bed that I couldn't sleep. I was so excited that night. I was like, this was amazing. This was unbelievable. Like, I love this. And I just was like, I want it again. And I want that fix again. I want to get into this thing again. And so from that point on, anything in Afghanistan for me was like combat. We got to be in combat. Like, what can we do to be in combat?
Man, there are so many things I just want to dive into here. Let's talk about this feeling of not wanting it to end. I think many vets can relate to that. How do you feel looking back now on that in terms of, is that a healthy type of addiction or like drug to start getting into? I feel like at the time it's almost necessary so you can go and do that day in and day out like you guys did.
Yeah.
How do you think back on it now, especially, I mean, you're very accomplished in what you've done. Like, how do you see that today?
Yeah. You brought up a good point. Thank God that I loved it, because otherwise, I mean, you go mad. Right. And for me, it was, you know, it was good feeling to have, because, you know, that happens a month and a half in deployment, you still have 5.5 months left. So you better want a little bit more of that. You better look forward to that. But it was really interesting to me, you know, as I kind of look back on things now as to what that developed into, right? Like wanting to go out and kill people.
Right.
Like legitimately being like, I want to go out and I want us to kill as many people as we can today. And then when you're walking through a field of dead bodies, you are genuinely excited and happy for what you've just accomplished. Cause like that was a good day's work, right? You're just like a Wall Street banker that made a good trade, right? Or, you know, someone who won an award at work, or you just made a $500,000 sale, right? That's what that was. And you had to view it that way. And I think it was almost like this coping mechanism because you had to view it in that manner. And if you didn't, you would have went insane. You had to want it. You had to want that going forward. Because otherwise, like, how are you going to get up every day and go out and do it? And so when I think about it now and I look back on it, in my recovery after getting wounded, there was definitely periods of being addicted to my pain meds. The parallels that I drew between the addiction of combat and the addiction to opiates was, I mean, it lined right up, man. It lined right up. Combat was something that I was addicted to, and the thrill of it and the rush of it and what could happen. I wanted it, but I knew that it could kill me. I knew that it wasn't good for me. I knew it wasn't the right way for me to be thinking. I knew it could destroy me ultimately.
Even then, you knew that, Kevin?
I mean, not necessarily then, but I think when I look at it now, or when I would be thinking about like comparing the two parallels, right? Back then, that's just what I wanted.
Right.
You know, like the feeling of surviving a mission and flying back on a Chinook was like one of the most amazing experiences. Like, wow, I've cheated death once again. Mm-hmm. And the crazy thing would be is like, you know, then you'd go to sleep for 12 hours, 16 hours, and then wake up and realize you had to go out and do it again. But, you know, I think, you know, when I think of, you know, the periods of addiction, it was like, I knew it wasn't good for me. Right? I knew it was potentially ruining my life. It was terrible for me. And so the parallels that I drew between those two periods of my life were very similar.
Wow. I interviewed Bob Keller, who's a former Green Beret and Delta operator. He's since retired, but he described it the same way. Like first time he had a chance to get into the fight, he was sprinting towards it and just was always looking for the next gunfight and loved the adrenaline of it. And just seems some people are wired that way. And it coping mechanism, it probably makes you highly effective in those environments. It's just later on can be difficult process. Just before we move on to another combat experience of yours, I wanted to circle back to two points that you made because I had similar experiences and I want to just share with people how frustrating and difficult it can be. So you were mentioning you were on the 50 cal, you didn't get any shots off. I think to people who haven't been in combat, they might say, how is that? I mean, you're in a firefight for hours. How can you not get shots off? One of the more intense engagements I was in from the air in an Apache, I had the same thing. Like guys on the ground are getting lit up. We're trying to engage. We know there's bad guys down there. We don't have a clear line of sight. We can't separate friendly from the enemy. It's so frustrating in the heat of the moment. The radios are kicking off. Like you're hearing the screaming and you can't do anything. You just feel terrible about it. So I can relate to the way you described that for sure in that setting. And then the other you mentioned was the compound that you did not hit. We had a night fight that we were in and we about sent a hellfire into a cave and we just didn't feel right about it. Watched it for a little bit longer and women and children came out of this cave, you know, and it was just a decision amongst us as a crew, like, hey, we're just not going to take a shot here. We'll wait. Had a little bit of pressure to take the shot, but we didn't. But man, I can't even imagine what that would have done to me psychologically later on to have pulled the trigger there. So anyway, I definitely feel what you're talking about when you mention those.
A lot of split second decisions to make at a very young age to think about the rest of your life.
Yeah, for sure. And I would love, Kevin, if we could jump to the injury you've referred to. I know you've told this story many times. I would just love to hear it though. leading up to, and then how you dealt with it afterwards, if you don't mind sharing again.
It's pretty interesting. It's you know, mentioned three wise men also. I had the St. Michael's medal that I would wear. My mother-in-law gave it to me the day I graduated the Q course. St. Michael, patron saint of soldiers. And I wore it every single day. Philippines, Afghanistan, to Thailand, back to Afghanistan, training, not training, just never stopped wearing it. And the mission before I got shot, we were in this village, you know, small skirmish firefight. It's like the third time we'd been there, third firefight. And then we're getting ready to get picked up and we're standing on a rooftop of an old school. And I'm up there with my 18 Fox, the intelligence sergeant. And I'll say, all right, man, well, where are we going to go next? And he turns around and he points to the valley behind him. And I was like, wow, is it going to be bad there? He's like, oh yeah, it's going to be bad there. And I was like, all right, well, that's good then, right? That's good. And we go back to the base and I see the, we go back to this base and I'm getting ready to work out. I go to take my chain off my I would take it off just to work out. And because I'm, you know, 26, 27 years old in great shape, of course, I never work out with a shirt on and just a pair of short, silky Ranger panties, of course, right? There's a lot of hubris in my story until this fateful moment. And I take the chain and I'm like, where's the medal? Where's the pendant? The pendant, the St. Michael's, the medal had fallen off in the village on the previous mission, right? The mission before I go on the fateful mission, right? Like, oh, I don't know. I've had a feeling my number was going to be coming up here at some point, but I'm like, that's not good. And I go and I check the roster for the mission after I get done working out. Like, there's a problem here. My name's not on it. So I go see the team sergeant and I'm like, hey, Sean, what's up, man? How come I'm not gone? What we would do is we'd have a QRF 99.9% of the time. We wouldn't call him QRF commander. You know, it's like almost like rotating a guy out for the night and just giving them a break. You know, they're got their gear on. They're watching a movie in the ops end, kind of listening to the radios. And I knew something was going to happen. And so I'm like, I have to be on this mission. This is what I said to him when I mentioned hubris. I was like, you wouldn't bench Michael Jordan during the finals, would you?
Wow.
And, you know, I think he loved the confidence that I had in myself. And I will say, you know, undoubtedly, I was not Michael Jordan of the Green Berets, right? Maybe like a developmental league guy that rode the bench. He's like, after, you know, I talked to him for a little bit. I'm like, look, man, we're going to get into some shit. You're going to need me out there. He's like, all right. If you can find someone to take your spot, no problem. And we were staging out of the B team headquarters, or, you know, company headquarters at the time. So I easily could find a B team guy that'd be like, hey, could you be the QRF commander? And maybe there's like this 0.1% chance that you might get into this fight. So they like, of course I'll be the commander. So, found that and was able to go on this mission. And it was a typical valley clearing operation we had done a number of times. We'd get dropped off at one end of a valley, you know, via Chinooks. We'd have Blackhawks kind of like put a mortar team, some sniper positions on the mountains that encase the valley. And it was typical, right? It was an hour before sun comes up. We start clearing, you know, but as soon as the sun starts coming over the mountains, near ambush kicks off on one of my teammates. And it's just kind of this mad rush to figure out what we're going to do and what we're going to, who's going to, you know, what maneuvering are we going to do, right? And, you know, going up there, saying to myself, thinking like my 7-8, which is like your infantry manual. All right, man, I'm just going to have him lay a base of fire down. I'm going to push through this thing. I'll have him lift and shift fire. We'll clear through. We'll kill all these guys. It was amazing to me, like in that moment of chaos, I'm like, visualizing this, you know, from my infantry manual of, you know, the things that we had practiced so many times. And, you know, I get to the position to be able to do something like this. And obviously every other guy in my team had the same idea, right? You know, they've read the same book, surprisingly. And it was just like, hey, you know, we had Cass on station and dropped a bomb on the location. And so after we drop on the location, I'm thinking like, that's it. And that's going to be kind of the end of the fight for the day. But that really just emboldened the spirits of the enemy on that day. And for the next 10 hours, right, we're just go back and forth in this valley. And it's September. So it's like, you know, in the 90s, it's still pretty warm out there. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. It's not constant fighting for 10 hours, right? I literally took a 20-minute nap at one point when we like pulled up and called a halt and got some security up on a compound. You know, and then the fight picks up and you start moving again throughout everything. And so in that 10th hour, I went around the corner of a building and it felt like I got hit in the stomach with a sledgehammer. And next thing you know, I'm laid out on the ground, pain worse than anything I'd ever felt in my life. I crawl back to my headset that got knocked off. I never buttoned my helmet in combat, which is probably a really stupid thing running around like John Wayne. I just never did though. And I guess I found out why you should. So it, came off, my earphones come off. I crawl back, I put them on, and I just like muster up as much strength as I could to start talking on the radio, telling my teammates I'd been shot. I remember afterwards, my team sergeant, he made me repeat myself a couple times. I'm like, what am I not saying clearly? I've been shot. This is my call sign, my location. And he's like, I just didn't believe you'd been shot because you were so calm on the radio. And I don't think that's a testament to me. I think that's a testament to the training of everybody from my team, the Q course and all these people that trained me for this moment, right? The seminal moment when my life hung in the balance. I get off the radio and I start trying to treat myself. I had this pain in my hip and my stomach and my left leg. I thought I'd been shot in the leg too. So my buddy, you got about 2 minutes to live. And grab my tourniquet, start patting up and down my leg, trying to see where the blood's coming from so I know where to put the tourniquet. But there wasn't anything. And on the like the third pass up, I go to my stomach and I see a little blood on my t-shirt. And I realize I'd been shot in the stomach. And there was no exit wound. There's nothing I can do. I'm just sitting out in the middle of the open. So, pain is just, I feel like I'm going in and out of consciousness so bad. And I get back on the radio. It felt like 5 years had gone by. And I had a lot more fear, a lot more sense of urgency. My voice calling my teammates, let them know that I had been hit. And then they're trying to get to me, but it's, and they're pinned down. The fight had really picked up at that point, right? Nobody was taking a nap at that point. And I look up and there's an Afghan soldier that spent almost 2 years training. He runs around the corner of the building, takes me by my body armor while bullets are flying around us and brings me behind the cover, behind the building to get some cover. And that's when my teammates begin to flood in and people start working on me. I'm laying on the ground. Guys are coming up to me with tears in their eyes, telling me they love me. They hadn't paid me a compliment in like 3 years. And people are coming up to the medic and saying, is Kevin going to make it or not? I'm like, I don't know. You know, it looks pretty bad. And I can hear them talking the whole time. And I'm like on the ground. And I'm starting to be like, this is it, man. You are experiencing your last moments here on this earth. And so about 45 minutes from the time that I was shot till they got into the surgery tent, to the helicopter. We have this on helmet camera. The guy had his helmet camera running. It's insane that he just happened to have it at this point. And then they get me to the surgery tent. It's like a 15-minute ride. You know, they bring me in. They're cutting my uniform off. There's instruments clanging in the background, people talking, and the surgeon's asking me questions. They're like, do you have any questions for me? So, well, am I going to live? He said, I don't know. It looks pretty bad. Do you have any last requests? And so I asked him for the bullet, and I have the bullet at home. Cut it out of my left butt cheek, you know. I tell people, I'm like, I could show you where they took it from. It'd be like this Forrest Gump moment, right? I said, I need a Catholic priest to give me my last rites because I'm going to die. And then I'll never forget the mask coming down on my face and asking God for forgiveness for my sins and saying goodbye to this world.
Wow. Thank you for sharing. And I know there's more to this, but just briefly, you mentioned this 45 minutes between the injury and getting on the helicopter. I assume it would feel like eternity, but as best you can, what are some of the things you remember going through your head? I mean, you're married at the time, right? No kids.
Yeah.
I believe kids. Like, I mean, how, what other stuff goes through your, I've never been shot. Like, what goes through your mind at that point in time?
Well, I hope you don't have to, because I'll ruin the surprise for you. It hurts a lot. So.
Spoiler.
Yeah. Well, so there's kind of like two parts to all of this, right? There's the pre-fentanyl part and then the post-fentanyl lollipop part, right? Yeah. You know, we would carry our narcotics in our right pocket, so everybody knew where to go. They gave me this fentanyl lollipop. They duct taped it to my finger. And the whole time, they're just screaming at me, Kevin, Kevin, don't bite it. Don't bite it, Kevin. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm telling them, shut the fuck up. I'm not biting it. I know not to bite this, but I couldn't formulate the words. And so I'm just like with this fentanyl lollipop, you know, I'm like drooling practically. And, you know, once that thing kicked in, I'm like, oh my God, I feel good. Do you guys need me to stay here for a little bit? Cause I think I can do this for a couple more hours, or maybe I'll just fly to the surgery center on my own. So it's kind of pre and post. Your first instincts are survival, right? And when I got shot, it was crazy. Like this moment from the Q course of talking to this old ranger who was like giving advice on what to do when you got shot started going through my head, like, hey, control your breathing, calm down, right? So you're not elevating your heart rate, elevating your blood. Like, that ran through my mind. and that's what I tried to do. And tried to just stay conscious, knew I needed to let my teammates know where I was. Then you try to treat yourself, right? It's just all this muscle memory just kicked in. And I mean, that is the power of the United States military. It kicked in when I needed it to. You know, you get behind cover and then the pain really sets in. You know, people are talking to you and you start to think like, this is it, right? You've had a lot of close calls and this time is it. I had a really close call on my first deployment. As I mentioned, I got to do two helicopter assaults. The first one was with that other special operations unit. The second one was into another 10-hour firefight. And I was trapped on a mountain during that one and was very certain I was going to die. It was like 130 degrees. Every time I moved, machine guns just, it was like, could feel the bullets passing by me. And I had a conversation with myself on that mountaintop at 26. And I didn't necessarily like all the answers that I got back because I was like, this is your deathbed. And so when I got back from the deployment, I tried as hard as I could to take that experience and enact the lessons that I learned. I didn't do great at it. Trust me. It was, you know, a very dark period in between the two deployments. I did the best that I could. And I firmly believe in that second moment there when I was shot and Ashley was like, well, you were really going to die. It wasn't as terrifying as it was the first time for me, right? Because I had that experience. I had those lessons. I tried to apply them in my life as much as I could. I did the best that I could. And so in this second time, I wasn't panicking. I wasn't necessarily begging God, like, oh my God, I'm not going to see my wife again. I'm not going to have children. Oh my God, I didn't live the life the way that I wanted to. Because that first time around, I thought to myself, there's always going to be another time, right? You're always going to get a chance to see somebody. I was like, whoa, holy shit. Your time is up now. There is no other time. I'm looking at a picture of my wife thinking this is it. And so I didn't want to ever feel like that again. And I tried to apply that and not take things for granted all the way up until me getting shot. And in that moment, like, I was sad that I'd never seen my wife again, but I felt ready to go.
And then on the tail end of all the operations, I know, like, you lost, I think, you fact check me, 20% of your colon comes out. You got like 4 feet worth of scars on your body. As you're coming out of that, how are you approaching this next phase of your life?
Yeah, I mean, I basically, as I alluded to earlier, became addicted to my pain meds. You know, my wife sits me down and has an intervention, you know, very big come to Jesus talk. You know, realized for me, I needed to set some big goals for myself. I had to get myself motivated. So that's where I came up with the concept of, like, I'm going to go to like a Harvard or an MIT for graduate school. I needed that. Right? I needed that huge goal. It's nearly impossible to focus myself 110% on, so I could be like, all right, you want to do this, you can't be on pain meds. You can't be drinking all the time. You got to get your ass up and you got to do these things. And so that, I think, kind of set the trajectory. We talked about the ambition piece.
Yeah.
That kind of set that trajectory for the ambition piece of having to have these big goals to give myself something to look towards, like to prove it to myself, prove it to other people.
Damn. And when does Wounded by War come about?
You know, I think, you know, an important thing for people to think about when they're going through a tough, difficult time in their life, you say to yourself, well, how could I be in a position to help somebody else out? I think that's probably the perfect time to help someone because it's going to give you purpose. It's going to give you meaning. You're putting others above yourself. It gives you good perspective. And, you know, one of the things that I noticed was my recovery was hard. There's no other way around. It was brutal. But I had an incredible support network. And, you know, not everybody had that out there. And so I really enjoyed working with other wounded veterans. And I thought, like, how can I do this on a bigger level? And it was like one night, so God woke me up out of my sleep and said, you should start writing, start a blog. And so I literally shot out of bed and immediately started writing that morning. And I got the website up and everything. And I'd said I was going to write before, and, you know, I was going to start Monday, and Monday would come and it would never happen. But this gave me the accountability to do it. And so I just started writing. And I thought, well, if I was really transparent, this will help some other wounded veterans. But I found out pretty quickly that it was pretty inspiring to other people. Right? And the more candid that I could be throughout the whole process, the more it could help other people. So that's really how it started out. And you know, some people would ask me to speak. And I was like, oh, wow, you know, this could actually be something to be very helpful. Some people had to sit through some very bad speeches. You know, I still don't think I'm the best orator yet. It's better than what it was prior. So that was really kind of the genesis of it. And it's been interesting for me because as I've gotten older and experienced different things in life, different lessons have been taught to me. And my perspective on things has changed. And so it kind of brings a unique, the lessons that I'm learning and what I can give to other people and how I can help them out. And so now it's not just about like building resilience or overcoming adversity or obstacles and spending time in the business world, you know, applying a lot of those and like, oh, wow, this applies to this situation and I can give that to other people.
Very cool. What was the first blog post that you ended up writing?
I think it was called Take the First Step was the first one. And that was like, you know, talking about the day that I got shot and I believe being in the hospital bed and like saying like, me sitting up in the hospital bed was the first step to my recovery. I was so nervous to put that out there because I just didn't know, like, it's the quiet professionals, right? Not a lot of Green Beret books out there, not a lot of Green Beret movies out there. So I was pretty nervous to do that. For a long time, I was nervous to speak in front of other Green Berets, but realized I was kind of onto something and then helping other people out. So overcame that.
Can I ask, I feel the same way. For those who can relate, when you were speaking in front of other Green Berets, did you get any of these, did anything tangible happen that you had worried about? Like whatever it was that you were afraid would happen, did you notice any of that and you just had to push through, or it didn't really materialize and it was something that you just made up in your head as a fear?
Yeah. I mean, I was worried that people would think I was like showboating and
right.
Being the quiet professional. I think 99.9% of people get it. That like what I'm doing, like I'm not doing it for attention or anything. It's never been about that. It's just truly to help other people out and take, quite frankly, a traumatic experience that I've undergone and allow other people to benefit from it. You know, every once in a while you get, I don't know if it's a troll or something like on Instagram or something will say something like, you don't know what you're talking about. Like,
yeah,
I ever had somebody say like, you know, this guy only did 2 deployments. And I'm like, I did 2 deployments because I was shot and I'm disabled for the rest of my life. And, you know, I couldn't walk. So that's the reason why my SF career was cut short. But I'm honestly, that is like the exception, you know, exception.
Yeah. That's great to hear. That's great to hear. I mean, not that part, but that it's the exception. That's great. I just have a couple questions I like to ask everybody that I would like to jump to, but I also want to make sure that if there are any other initiatives you're involved in, that we make sure that we highlight them here. So is there anything else that you're working on right now? I know that Wounded by War has a documentary on it. You've got the head cam footage, as you mentioned. So I'll try to have links to that, but is there anything else that you're working on right now that you'd like to put in front of people?
Yeah, a couple of different things. I do a lot of motivational speaking. I had the opportunity to speak to Fortune 500 companies, athletic teams, incarcerated veterans, and you name it. I've had that opportunity. So if you're looking for a motivational speaker, someone who's going to talk about adversity, overcoming that resiliency, building yourself up, I think my story relates to people on so many different levels. Because it's not all about combat. It's really about what happened after I got shot. And so many people can relate to the things that I've gone to on that level. So please keep me in mind for that. I also do workshops with companies on team building, resilience. Please contact me for that. You can follow me at Wounded by War on Instagram. That's my Facebook page. Hit me up on LinkedIn. Those are kind of my main social media. I haven't figured out Twitter yet. I don't know that that'll ever.
I'm with you.
But I'm also on the board of directors of the Green Beret Foundation. It's an incredible organization that was there for my wife and I since day one. And you know, when we finally got to a point physically, mentally, emotionally, where I could give back, jumped at the opportunity to work with the foundation, and now have this honor to be on the board of directors.
Fantastic. And I see you got the shirt on too.
Of course, I had to rep it.
That's right. Yeah, that's great. I'll have links to all this so people can find you for sure.
Thank you.
And then just the last two questions I try to ask everybody. You've alluded to one of them, but I think from looking at some of the photos, there might be more here. Was there anything that you carried with you into combat that you really wanted to have with you each time? Carried sentimental value, good luck charm, something to that effect? You mentioned the St. Michael's medal. What else did you have with you, if anything?
I used to take my old wrestling characters like Macho Man Randy Savage and Ultimate Warrior and stuff, like the little figurines, and I duct taped them all to the back of my body armor.
Would you have like one or two each time? Would you rotate them out?
I've rotated most out, you know, like Hacksaw and Hulk Hogan, but Macho Man died on the deployment, so I wore him in memory the whole deployment, and I dedicated the deployment to him.
Love it. Love it. And then the last one is, especially for you with the injury that you've described here, the near-death experiences, as you kind of look back at that time and all that you went through, both during your time in service and since, would you go back and do that again?
110%. Even if I knew everything, even if I knew I would have to walk in the same exact path, in the same exact footsteps, I would definitely do it again.
Not surprised to hear that. Well, I really appreciate the time, Kevin. This was a lot of fun. Thank you for going into detail and sharing some of the harder points there. I know people can relate. I can myself. So thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this combat story. People often write to me with incredible stories and suggestions for interviews. If you want to share a combat story of your own or from someone you served with, record yourself for up to 5 minutes and email it to ryan@combatstory.com. I'll select some of these stories and feature them at the end of our episodes. Thanks for listening. Stay safe.